It is 7:32, and we have with us live in the studios this morning for Community Forum, Dr. Stephen Gilbert. He is director of the Institute of Neurotoxicology and Neurological Disorders. He's also a associate professor at the University of Washington in the Department of Environmental Science and Occupational Health. I think I messed that up.
Department of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences.
Sorry about that. Well, good morning. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you, Mike. It's great to be here.
Let us begin with, if you could tell us, what is toxicology and how did you get involved with it?
Well, toxicology is the study of the health effects of chemicals, and my interest has been primarily on children. I did a lot of research on the effects of lead and mercury, particularly low levels exposure of lead and mercury, and working to get lead out of gasoline, for example, and trying to reduce mercury contamination in fish.
Okay, and how does one develop the knowledge of what the levels are that are toxic to different people?
Well, that's a big question, and we could start by just thinking about ourselves. And for caffeine, for example, how much caffeine we consume and the effects of caffeine on our own bodies, and probably many of the listeners have had a little bit too much caffeine to drink before. And that's one way to look at toxicology. Another way is looking at contaminants like mercury and lead, and looking at animal studies and looking at how the poisons affect animals, and then doing more detailed studies on humans. So there's a range of approaches to that. The government, for example, the Environmental Protection Agency and the Food and Drug Administration have a series of tests that they require to approve the efficacy and safety of many of the compounds that we're exposed to. And also, unfortunately, a lot of compounds are not tested. Like right now, there's about 80,000 compounds that are in commerce, and many of those, the vast majority of those, are not well tested, and we really don't understand the toxic effects or potential effects of those compounds.
So when did things start getting, I don't even know if we could use the word aggressive, when did things start getting regularly tested prior to going to market?
Well, that's just been gradually happening, and as we learn more about the effects of compounds, for example, it was once thought that the placenta was a pretty good barrier and that protected the fetus from developmental effects of compounds. But in the 1950s, we learned that mercury would affect fetal development in Minamata, Japan. We found that mercury would get out, it was put out into the environment by corporations into the bay around Minamata, that mercury is taken up by fish. People consumed the fish, and there was effects on the fetus, the developing fetus. And then a little bit later, in the 60s, thalidomide incident occurred, where thalidomide was a drug used for anti-nausea drug during pregnancy and also as somewhat of a sedative. And it was discovered that that drug caused focalmelia, foreshortening of the arms during fetal development. And so at that point, the Food and Drug Administration really changed its approach and required a lot more stringent testing of drugs that are going to go out into human consumption. So the testing has gradually improved. And then, of course, in the 70s, they had other things, TSCA, Toxic Control Acts, where the government, we started doing a little bit more testing, a little more testing of pesticides. But we're still quite a ways away from having a consistent approach where industry must show the safety of compounds that they're putting out into the environment.
Yeah, it seems that our current system is more oriented towards they pull things off the market after something horrible has happened.
Right. That's actually, unfortunately, the way things seem to go. Where there's also the principle called the precautionary approach, which tries to change that around, which tries to shift the burden of approach to the proponent of a chemical, a proponent of activity. And you can contrast that with the Food and Drug Administration, where if a company, a chemical or a pharmaceutical company, wants to have a new drug on the market, the Food and Drug Administration requires that the company show efficacy, show that the product is going to do what it's supposed to do, and also show safety. So they have to compile the data, submit this, the FDA reviews it. Contrast that to, for example, ephedra, which was recently pulled off the market a few months ago. And ephedra was a compound, a nutraceutical, natural occurring compound that was used as a diet supplement to help people lose weight. And a baseball player died of that drug. And there was about 150 other deaths of that. So the nutraceutical companies are not required to show the compounds are efficacious or that they're safe. And the burden is put on the Food and Drug Administration, which is really society, to show that those drugs are potentially harmful. And the same approach is taken with a lot of compounds For example, lead, the same way, it was put out in the environment, and some would argue that lead is probably the greatest public health disaster of the 20th century, whereas really society had to show that lead was harmful, and a lot of work went into doing that, showing that very low levels of lead exposure is hazardous, and then it was removed from gasoline, and we're still struggling with getting lead out of the environment.
Actually, if we could pursue that for a little bit, because we've seen locally in our media a lot of attention on the Seattle School District, and mm-hmm. they've been discovering that, and it goes back quite a ways, that there is lead in some schools in their water systems and stuff. Do you think any of that's being overblown?
I don't. I think that there should be some focus on lead getting into the schools. And I think we need to look carefully at that, because that's one route of exposure. And it looks like some of that lead came from piping and lead solder in the pipes, and also some of the fixtures that in the drinking fountains can also leach lead into the water supply. And it's been shown that lead, at low levels of exposure, lead is harmful to the developing nervous system. The kids in schools, their nervous system is still developing. And that's only one route of lead exposure. If you're in a home that's older, that's pre-1978, you could have lead in the paint, and that lead gets into the dust. A young child that's on the carpet, for example, a 1 or 2 year old, could be exposed to lead in the carpet dust, and they have a lot of hand-to-mouth behavior. And the other interesting thing about lead is that, and this is, goes back to toxicology, one of the things that we learn, is that when you're young, an infant or even up to early adulthood, you absorb about 50% of the lead that you ingest, and an adult only absorbs 10% of that lead. And that's because lead substitutes for calcium, and your body, when it's young, needs more calcium to grow. So your gut is absorbing more lead, and that's what's happening in schools, that they'll absorb more lead, or if there's have lead around their home, they'll absorb more of that lead. So I think it's very important that we pay attention to these low-level exposures in our environment.
And sticking with lead for a minute, what are the long-term effects and short-term effects of that?
Well, the long-term effects are that they can rob the potential of a child. So a child has a certain potential, and lead can take that away. And it's it might not be too much. It can be a few drop in IQ points. For example, you know, I grew up in the 50s, and there was plenty of lead in the gasoline, a lot of lead around the environment. You know, and if I had a couple more IQ points, you know, I might have been a full professor at the University of Washington. You know, you never know about these things. But I think that's one of the difficulties of getting a handle on lead exposure, is that you can't look at an individual with low-level exposure and say they've been affected. But they could have had a few IQ points reduced, and a higher level of exposure has potential to contribute to learning disabilities or hyperactivity of kids. So it has real impact on the quality of life of kids. So I think that is the most serious effect of lead. It's the subtle exposure. It's not going to cause, at the levels we're now exposed to, death. It used to be more serious, and some kids are still have dramatic effects. That lead's a little bit sweet. So if there's paint chips with lead in it, kids will eat those paint chips, called pica. So they will have more exposure, and it can be fatal. They'll have, at the higher end of exposure, the brain swells and the child will die. But at lower levels of exposure, it is affecting the nervous system development and robbing the child of potential. And we don't want to take away from a child's potential, and that's a lifetime effect from lead exposure.
I know with more general in toxics that there's a lot of focus. We tend to, as a society, focus on the extreme dosages, because obviously that kills. But I know from what my dealings have been with downwinders over at Hanford with radioactive elements there, that actually the low doses in many ways are more dangerous in the long run, because where the high doses would, you know, drop you in your tracks, low doses are doing this long-range damage that you don't see immediately, and then you're going and passing it on to others and basically carrying on your life without knowledge that you're carrying this stuff.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, that it is the low-level chronic exposure that can be very serious. You take smoking, for example. Your low-level chronic exposure to cigarette smoke eventually causes lung cancer and other cardiovascular diseases. So it is that low-level exposure. Alcohol can be much the same way, where a little bit's okay, but if you consume it for a long period of time, it can cause liver problems and things like that. So it is the low-level exposures. And I think that's one thing in the last 20 years we've really learned from toxicology, is it's not the high levels, the high dose exposures. So those are very important and critical. It really is these lower level chronic exposure that we have to be paying attention to. A good example, that's mercury in our fish, and there's a lot of effort to reduce mercury exposure in our environment. The state government did a great job a couple years ago putting out the Mercury Chemical Action Plan, trying to get people to turn in mercury-based thermometers. A lot of our thermostats in our homes have mercury in them, and trying to control the release of mercury in the environment. That mercury gets into the fish, it bioaccumulates in the fish, that is, it builds up in the muscle of the fish. We consume the fish, and then we're exposed to that, so there's pretty strict limits on the recommendations on the amount of mercury that women of childbearing age and children can consume, and that's back to low-level exposures where that small amounts of mercury can affect the developing nervous system. So really, we really have moved from concern about high levels, high exposures that will drop you and kill you, to very low-level exposures and really protecting the potential of people and protecting the quality of life.
My understanding as well on that, there's been, as you pointed out earlier, minimal testing on the thousands of chemicals that we have out there in regular daily use in our environment. There's been minimal testing on those individually, but there's been next to no testing on the interactions of those different chemicals. Is that true?
You bring up a really great point that we are exposed to multiple chemicals, and there is very little testing on multiple chemical exposures. That's a very tough problem. It's hard to deal with scientifically. It's hard to design good studies to assess that. But we are exposed to many chemicals. Most recently has been brominated flame retardants have come up as a big issue, and we found that these are leaching out of the plastics at our computer tops and our television sets and our carpet, the foam under our seats, our foam and our mattresses. Many of you that might still be in bed are probably sleeping on brominated flame retardants right now. And it's turned out that these chemicals are absorbed, and they are a lipophilic, that is, they go to fat, and that we found that these chemicals can be excreted in the breast milk of women. But there's multiple chemicals. We're exposed to mercury, we're exposed to lead, we're exposed to pesticides. So we have a wide range of chemicals that we're exposed to. What we need to be thinking about is what are the interactions of those, and what's our response to them? Because we want to look at, in toxicology, the big thing is dose and response. What's the dose? What's the response? So how much you exposed to, and how do you think about your response to those chemicals? And now we have a mixture of these chemicals, and what's our response to those mixtures?
Yeah, I know with the brominated flame retardants, we should all be very proud that I believe this area rated the highest in the country for the amount of brominated flame retardants in women's breasts.
Yeah, there was a study done recently supported by a number of local groups here, and they looked at women's breast milk and found brominated flame retardants. It was a study done actually in a number of sites across the country, but Seattle did rank right up there. And the state is actually looking into that. There is a panel. They're coming up with an action plan for brominated flame retardants. This panel is going on right now, and it meets periodically. And you can get more information on that at the state website and the Department of Ecology and the Department of Health. And I would urge people to pay attention to these issues. You can get involved. You can go to these meetings, learn more about brominated flame retardants. Coming up soon will also be meetings on persistent bioaccumulative toxicants, and these are chemicals that are persistent in environments, such as some of the older pesticides, DDT, PCBs, mercury, lead, and we're trying to figure out which of these chemicals should be studied and which can the state can help eliminate and reduce, such as brominated flame retardants. Which ones do we want to restrict and start, really trying to reduce our use of these chemicals in the environment? Pesticides, for example, do we really need to be spraying all the roadsides? Some of the counties have reduced spraying around the roadsides. Can we reduce the use of pesticides in our school systems and move toward more of an integrated pest management system and try to be more thoughtful about how we use chemicals in our environment and what we're exposed to?
Well, I think you're being pretty generous there with just even saying more thoughtful. It seems like a lot of situations where you use no thought at all. I neglected when I was introducing you to mention your book, Small Dose of Toxicology, which is a good resource people can turn to, as well as you have a website.
Yeah, I have a website. My website's asmalldoseof.org. And on that website, it supports the book, and each chapter of the book has many references and PowerPoint presentations that you can download. So I really tried to create a tool that would help people understand a little bit more about toxicology. It actually is a fun subject. I think toxicology is very fun. The book says a lot of quotes, a little bit of history. You look at the historical look at some of these compounds. So you take arsenic, and there were periods of time when it was very popular for arsenic to be used for women to kill off their husbands and gain access to their fortunes, and they used arsenic a lot. So there's a lot of very fun history in toxicology, and we're exposed to toxic compounds all the time and effects of these things. And, you know, you take a caffeine, for example, and you ask why Starbucks makes so much money from caffeine, and you couldn't design a better drug to make money off of than caffeine.
Why is that?
Well, caffeine's got some really interesting properties. Many of us drink caffeine or a bit of caffeine in the morning, so it's a great stimulant. It sort of wakes us up and gets us going. And I look across at Mike having a little sip of coffee right there. It's good.
Yeah.
And but you can't drink too much of it. You can't go out and just drink 5 cups of coffee. All of us, or many of us, have probably noted that if you drink too much, you get that anxiety, very anxious feeling. So that's a toxic effect. That's a neurotoxic effect. So it's part of caffeine affecting your nervous system. So another thing is, with caffeine, it's metabolized fairly rapidly, and that is the half-life. So if you get your caffeine levels up to your blood caffeine levels to, say, 10, how long does it take for it to drop down to half of that? That's called the half-life. So with that, it's short. So the half-life of caffeine is, 4 to 5 hours. So you metabolize it fairly rapidly, so you've got to go back and get another cup of it. And you also, many people have a headache if they stop drinking caffeine. So that means you're mildly become drug dependent. So it's got these great qualities, a short half-life. So you have to go back and have a little bit more of it every day. You get up, have your first cup. A little bit later, you want to go back and have some more of it. You can't drink a lot of it all at one time, sort of stoke it up because of the adverse effects of it. And you can't stop drinking it because you get a headache. So, and it also has a pleasant effect. So you couldn't really design a better drug for the coffee and cola companies to make money off of than caffeine.
Talk a little bit about another two different elements that are in your book that you focus on that we willingly consume in large quantities, is both alcohol and nicotine. And it seems that with all the deaths that are related to those two, some are indirect from, let's say, driving a car drunk, but from the direct deaths related to that, it seems odd that, we put so much focus on some of these other toxins or toxicants, I'm not sure which, to eliminate those from our environment, yet we freely sell things like nicotine and alcohol over the counter and make a lot of profit off it.
Yeah, that's a real interesting contradiction in our society. Take nicotine, for example. There's been a lot of effort, particularly in the last few years, to point out that nicotine is addictive, and it was finally sort of beaten home. I think the Food and Drug Administration and the Clinton administration did just a great job on that they did point out that it appeared that the tobacco companies were manipulating the nicotine levels in the cigarettes. They tried to get a regulation, and FDA wanted to regulate the effects of nicotine as a drug. So if you are manipulating the effects of a compound like that, then it could be seen as a drug. And cigarettes are basically a drug delivery device. They deliver nicotine. You inhale that drug. It's absorbed through your lungs very rapidly and moves into your bloodstream and goes quickly to the brain. So it is a drug. It's a very potent drug, very addictive drug, and we don't regulate it well in our society. Right now, there's a bill before Congress where they're, I believe it passed, where they're working to phase nicotine out for farming and subsidizing the farmers and tobacco growers. And part of the deal was that the Food and Drug Administration would then be able to regulate nicotine as a drug. I'm not exactly sure the status of all that, but that's one of the efforts to try to get a handle on that drug and try to control its use in our society, because it is hugely costly to the medical institutes. And we saw how they tried to get some of the money back from the drug, tobacco mm-hmm. companies, and trying to, one of the arguments was that society pays for the health effects of those compounds. And that's the externalization of costs. I mean, it gets into a little bit deep subject here, but the drug companies, and tobacco companies, have really externalized the health effects of that, their product, onto society. We pay for the medical effects of those compounds. The tobacco companies do not, and that's one of the reasons they try to get some of the money back from the tobacco companies, so to pay for those health effects of that compound. So you got to look at that all over the place, how companies move to push their costs out. Alcohol is a bit the same thing, where the companies sell alcohol, all kinds of beverages, from wine to hard liquors to beers, And the society pays the health effects of those compounds, whether it's car accidents, for example, which is a direct, in my view, a direct effect of consumption of those products. That's one of the consequences of that, all the way to alcoholism, liver cirrhosis, and other societal effects of that.
I'm wondering if we can focus a little bit on solutions. One of the things that I saw in your book, and I've heard it before, but for instance, I'm not the best housekeeper in the world. I have a bit more dust in my house than I should. And it's probably one of the reasons a lot of people don't visit me anymore. But I have friends that when I go to their house, they require that the shoes I'm wearing come off. Do you see that as a significant factor in maintaining our health?
I think taking your shoes off is probably one of the simplest and most effective ways you can help reduce exposure to chemicals in your home. Take, for example, pesticides. Pesticides, and more modern pesticides, are designed to break down in sunlight. And if you track pesticides indoors, there's less ultraviolet light, and the half-life, the time that pesticide stays indoors, is actually longer than it would outside. And this is really important if you have kids, young children, and even more important if you have carpets, because the deep dust in carpets can take up some of these pesticides and be attached to the and sort of bury themselves in the carpet. Lead's the same way if you have an older home, or if you, example, if you're near by a smelter or there'd been lead or arsenic drifted into your area. You track that lead and that arsenic, those compounds of pesticides, other things, into your home. It sits in the dust, and it sits in those carpets. So it's very important. Taking off your shoes reduces that. If you have pets, you got to think about what the pets are tracking in. And if you have carpets, one thing you can do, it's a fun little experiment to do, is take a new bag for your vacuum cleaner, put a new vacuum cleaner bag in there. If you have a scale, weigh that bag first. Then take a square yard of carpet and just vacuum it for like 5 or 10 minutes. And you'll be astonished at how much dust you get out of that small area of carpet if you just sit there and do that. We've done some studies on that with the Master Home Environment, which is run out of the American Lung Association of Washington here. And they've done little studies showing that that carpet area, you can get a pound of dust out of your carpet. It's astonishing.
The precautionary principle, we tend to hear a lot from the side of industry that, you know, there's, well, we're still working on studies, or there's no significant studies yet to show that this new compound we just came out with is killing people or, you know, causing them harm. Could you talk about why the precautionary principle is so key to dealing with those concepts and your work on it?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the precautionary principle is something we really need to talk more about. The approach is to do no harm and to be thoughtful about what you're doing. It's to look at alternatives. So you want to first look at alternatives. What could we use instead of this compound? For example, with pesticides, can we move more toward integrated pest management systems? So you want to have a precautionary approach toward the introduction of new compounds into the environment. And putting the burden, it also shifts the burden of responsibility into the proponents of using a certain compound. So they have to show that it's safe. And we've been working, there's a small group called the Seattle Precautionary Principle Working Group. It's out of the a local group, a CHE, Collaborative on Healthy Environment Northwest, which is a group working to bring more focus on environmental issues. But the city and King County comprehensive plans are due for renewal this year, and we've proposed amending the city, for example, Seattle City comprehensive plan to include the precautionary principle and approaches to that. And they have different elements in these comp plans. And one of the elements is the environment element. And one of the proposals we made was to change the name of the environment element to the environment and human health element. Because we're trying to bring more, a better linkage between the environment and human health, and showing that thoughts are what changes we make in the environment have big impacts on human health. For example, right down to transportation and the built environment, we have, and you can look at the statistics on this, there's increased incidence of obesity and people being overweight. And if you change how we build the environment, you get people walking and doing more things. With that, you have a reduction in diabetes. So we'd like to see health indicators incorporated into the comp plan. So we're making changes in transportation environment. It comes back to improving human health. And we can see reductions in obesity and people being overweight and asthma in kids, maybe birth weight of children. So I would urge everyone to get involved with the comp plan. You can contact the Office of Sustainability and Environment with the city. You can look up on the city website. They've got a great website for that. On my website, asmalldoseof.org, there's a lot more information on the precautionary principle, on the Seattle effort, and links into the city government. And you can contact some of the city council people that have been interested in this. It's been Richard Conlon and Nick Licata. We had a brown bag lunch where we had some experts come in, the national experts on the precautionary principle talked about it. So it's a very interesting concept of decision-making and really changing our focus on decision-making for introduction of new things and trying to improve human health.
All right. As well as, I was very jazzed to see that for the month of August, that
Office Depot.
Office Depot.
Yes.
Thank you. Office Depot has got a deal where people can bring in their old used electronics and get them taken care of for free.
Yeah, this is very exciting. I really commend Office Depot for doing that. And I took an old fax machine I had in there and just dropped it off. It was easy. It just took me like 30 seconds to walk in the door. They took a quick look at it. I had it boxed up, put it on the pile. And this is really, really important. And this is another example where we don't pay. We have our laptop computers and our cell phones. And into the cost of those products, we don't actually have the recycling costs built into those products. So it's another example where the corporations that manufacture these products have externalized the cost of recycling these materials. And Office Depot has taken that up. And one of the problems right now is a lot of these products go overseas, go to developing countries, and then kids are exposed to the compounds when they tear these products apart, going after the heavy metals, gold, mercury, lead in these products. So it's really great that Office Depot is doing that.
Yeah, they've combined with Hewlett-Packard on that. So, and normally, if you dispose of things properly, as we all should be doing, there's generally a stiff fee that, $25 thereabouts for bringing in just like a single monitor or TV.
Right.
So,
yeah, it's a great bargain. I urge everyone to look around their homes and take their products in. It's a great opportunity.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're just about out of time. Any final thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I think, we all need to be thinking about the dose of what we're exposed to and what our response is to that. And when we're young, as we get older, just be very aware. You've gotten, and you can expand this concept, you've got a bit of a dose of me this morning. You got to think about what that's like. And I urge you to take a look at my book, A Small Dose of Toxicology. It's a very, hopefully makes toxicology fun and reasonable and explores the health effects of many of the common chemicals we're exposed to. And please check out my website, www.asmalldoseof.org.
All right. Well, thank you for coming in this morning.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Mike.
We've just been talking with Dr. Stephen Gilbert. He is director of the Institute of Neurotoxicology and Neurological Disorders. And again, you can check out his book, A Small Dose of Toxicology, at your local bookseller. And check out his website at asmalldoseof.org.